We're in the company of historian Dr. Joe Kelly. Joe, thanks for that. I was looking just at some of the numbers. 12 independent TDs, 13 independent senators, some of them appointed by government, of course. Less than 200 county councillors around the country independent. It's not a bit wonder it's a struggle for different voices to get on the ballot paper when you look at the numbers like that. I thought, I don't know, I never really give it strong consideration before, but looking at those figures, the parties have it tied up.
Absolutely. And I don't think that's what the Constitution intended. And see, the question we have to ask ourselves then, as citizens of a republic, have we to tolerate the manipulation of our democracy and that the power lies in the hands of a few people, i.e. the political elite? I just wonder, has Simon Harris actually breached the code of conduct criminally by instructing his Fine Gael councillors to block someone? I can't understand that mentality. Is he saying, therefore, that we just want our person and we don't want anybody else's vote? So when it comes to an election, we don't want a transfer. If we don't want a number two or a number three. You see, that's my concern, that they've controlled all this. And here's maybe what people don't understand, Greg. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the political parties are funded to the tune of 5.1 million last year of your taxes, my taxes, and your listeners' taxes. That works out at 136,000 euro a day that's been given to the political parties in this country. Yes? And that money is used to promote their parties. And so, for example, if we take the last referendum where 84% of the people of Donegal voted no, the political parties had a budget to push for a yes. Those of us that wanted a no and campaigned for a no had zero of a budget. And if I were to stand for an election, I have zero of a budget. But if I'm in a political party, I have a share of 5.1 million of the taxpayers' money. So the government parties that are standing for the presidential election are being funded to run someone, and they are blocking anybody else from going.
But I mean, obviously, listen, you know, the key thing there is taxpayers' money, but Maria Steen's campaign would have been well funded through other avenues as well.
But through other avenues, not taxpayers.
No, I do understand. I'll take your point.
And just one other thing on that, Greg. If someone reaches a quarter of the quota, as I imagine all three will do, they will also get another 250,000 each. That's 750,000 further of Irish taxpayers' monies is going to be given to each of these presidential candidates for their campaign. Mm. They know that they will get that. If I were to stand for independent, or you would stand for independent, and we don't reach a quarter of a quota, we get zero. They will be guaranteed 250,000 more into their party funds so they can afford the posters. They can afford to use the media. Again, it seems to be a system in place where the political elite are usurping the situation to their own benefit.
Okay.
And so we're a very, very precarious position. And I heard Nicholas Crossan some weeks ago on, I thought he was very wise, the former mayor of Donegal, and he talked about Henry Ford, who produced a million Model T cars, and he wanted to produce them in such a speed that he didn't really care about the colour. And someone said to him, "Mr. Ford, why can't we have any other colours?" And he says, "Look, you can have whatever colour you want as long as it's black." And we have a presidential campaign at the moment. You can have any president you want, long as it's one of ours. Surely there's something wrong with that.
But Catherine Connolly's an independent, though. She might not align to your political way of thinking, but she is an independent candidate. Now, it so happens that she comes from a political sphere that they're rowing in behind her with the exact view, as they would see it, of breaking that sort of big party stranglehold on the presidency. So does that not contradict everything that you're saying?
I think, in fairness, Catherine Connolly cannot be tinged with the idea that she's usurped power. She's gone as an independent. She's managed to get her 20 nominations. She has done it, so to speak, the right way and has garnered support, be it from Sinn Féin or Paul Murphy or the left, and she's managed to create a coalition. Again, she's been very honest about her funding and where it's at and where it's coming from. So in fairness, that can't be thrown at Catherine Connolly. But it's the issue I'm not trying to, and please, it's not that I'm trying to go against Catherine or go against any of the other two candidates. My issue is it's the way that these people were put on the ballot and how others were blocked.
But just in relation to that, you call it blocked, right? And I want to get on to a historical review of some of our presidents, though.
Yes.
What is the alternative? you can't have a free-for-all, surely, because there'd be 300, 400, 700 people on the ballot paper. So you would have to, not you personally, propose a system that gets people onto the ballot paper, surely. I don't think even our founding fathers would have thought that every single person in the state could contest a presidential election.
Well, again, we go back to the unique privilege that county councillors had that wasn't given to lawyers or Gardaí or to teachers. It was given specifically to councillors. And many councils never even met or even considered giving a nomination. And I think that is a very, very wholesome way of doing
this. Yes, but you could be an independent councillor. And you might well be an independent councillor. But you might not agree with Maria Steen. So yeah. Why would you get involved in a meeting when you're not going to endorse her anyway? She is she comes from a political place that, you know, there's a great deal of support there, I'm sure. But if I was an independent councillor and I was given this great honour, if all that's presented to me would be Maria Steen and a few others, well, then what's the point in getting together? You have to then look at the quality of the candidates.
Well, I accept that, but even to have an interview of the candidates and to figure out what they are, I'm not really pushing the Maria Steen thing or the Gareth Sheridan.
No, but it's
thing.
The only, see, Maria Steen was the only one really, truly.
Gareth Sheridan was there as well.
Well, Gareth Sheridan was there, of course, He got two nominations.
Yeah, and it's just a pity. I mean, and whether I agree or disagree with Maria or Gareth or anybody else for that matter, I think a healthy democracy is one where you're given a choice.
Okay.
Personally, I think that Catherine Connolly missed a trick. I think what she should have done was sign the nomination papers for Maria Steen and say, look, I'm standing on my own beliefs, but I'm also a Democrat and a Republican, and I want to see other candidates. Because that's what Michael D. Higgins did. When he got nominated for the first time, he asked his Labour councillors to give nominations to other candidates.
Yeah, but Maria
Steen,
but politically,
magnanimous of him.
Of course it was, but the gap politically between Catherine Connolly and Maria Steen, it is a chasm.
Absolutely, but again,
it's a lot to ask for, because you know.
But this isn't about political ideologies. I understand.
But it is. I know what you're saying. It isn't. But
I'm on about democracy. See, democracy. People have views that are totally different to mine. We may disagree on views, but democracy is the best show in town. And okay, it has its faults. But people should be allowed to present themselves and go before the public. I even would argue that Conor McGregor should have been given the opportunity, and we would have seen that he mightn't have got as high a vote as people would have thought. I personally wouldn't have been a fan of his or would agree with his ideology or whatever else. But democracy.
But that means then, if you could get a convicted criminal and someone who's been found civilly responsible for a sexual assault, that means there's no bar then. There is no bar.
There is, insofar as you can't be a convicted criminal to get a president nomination. You have to be 36 to be, you know, stand for the president. There are certain criteria that you're...
Well, actually, I'm not sure if he had a criminal conviction, just to clarify. Yeah. I think he may have been... He was found responsible for an assault. There is a definition between that and being a convicted criminal. So just apologies in relation to that.
There is a civil... You're correct in saying that there was a civil case and he was convicted in the civil
court. That's
not
a criminal conviction. Either, is it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, well, you haven't said that, but you were mentioning the civil case, and you're correct in that. And so, for people, they would understand that to be barring to standing for president.
Douglas Hyde, our first president. Yeah. Talk to us about him. We're going to have to skip through these actually, because
Douglas the Hage was actually appointed. Was kind of an inter-party Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil came together and said, look, let's nominate someone. Douglas the Hage was appointed. He was a scholar. He was a man of learning and writing. Interestingly, he was a Protestant. Which in a new Ireland, you know, the idea that home rule was Rome rule, it showed how open we were as a country and that we weren't limited just by religion. I think that was fabulous. A man that I have a great admiration for, the Craven Even, would have come to Donegal on numerous occasions as a scholar and to College Jolly and got a hark and things like that. So he was a very, very quiet gentleman, and he had the for one term from 1938. He was appointed president on 25th of June 1938, and he held that office for 7 years. So that was Douglas the Hage. And he was then subsequently followed by Shanti O'Callaghan. And Shanti O'Callaghan would have been in the GPO in 1916. So we're getting our roots now of our presidents into the rising of 1916. And again, he was a Gaelgar. He was the editor of the Clave Sol is an Irish newspaper that Patrick Pearse was the editor for. He was a politician and a Fianna Fáil politician, and he served two times as president. And it was very much liked, a little small man. He wore the tall hat, and he had a bit of a character. But at that stage, the presidency wouldn't have had the media coverage or the media reach that we have today.
Well, they have the respect. Where was it, sure. I wonder, in terms of public respect?
See, sorry,
I wonder where the role of president was in terms of public respect.
Oh, absolutely. It was very, very much respected. There's no question about that. And we'll see that later on with Carlo Daly.
Well, De Valera's next then after your
namesake. He was a titan of Irish politics in the last century. There's no question of that. And personally, I would have loved to see Eamon O'Keefe's grandson stand for president. Mm. I would have loved to see him because he was a man that understood his grandfather's constitution and the role, and there was a great integrity and still is to that man. But
you were talking then about the sort of the party dominance that we see now. Arguably, though, you know, Fianna Fáil have had a big say in the presidency so far. So,
that's true.
Unpack that for us.
You have Patrick Hillary came later. You have Mary McAleese. You know, there's been quite a few. Eamon de Valera, Shanty O'Cally, Esker and Childers. He would have been Republican, and he didn't live very long. He was the only president to date to have died in office. He was president in 1973, and he died in 1974, and he got a state burial and funeral. And like Hyde, he was a Protestant, and it was very interesting.
We did talk about this extensively, but Erskine Childers, it's an interesting story with what happened to his father, etc.
Yeah, his father, you're right, we did talk about it. Father was executed as one of the 77 by the Free State because of the Civil War. He was on the anti-treaty side, and the pro-treaty side executed him. And before he was executed, he told his son to go round and meet every one of the men that would shoot him. And he did do that. And little did he think, some years later, that he would now become the president of the state that executed his father. You couldn't write it.
No. Next up is the only president to have resigned.
Yeah, Carlo Daly. Personally, I think, I don't know a terrible, terrible lot about him, but I think he would have been my favourite president.
Okay.
Because I think the man was exemplified absolute integrity, which our president should do. And he was made president in 1974. He was a chief justice and a judge, and he'd been on the European Court of Justice. And what happened was he referred a bill, which was his prerogative and right to do so. It was a criminal law that was being put through to deal with the IRA at the time. And he referred it to the High Court, which caused a delay. And when he signed it into law that day, the IRA had bombed Mount Mellick or whatever.
Manhattan.
The government, which was a Fine Gael government at the time, weren't happy that he'd made a delay on this law that they were trying to Criminal Justice Act. And actually, Patrick Donegan, the Fine Gael minister of the time, supposedly at a place that he was doing an official opening, called him a thundering disgrace. And this was a minister criticising the president. And the integrity in the man said, look, that's enough.
Yeah, I'm resigning. Okay.
And he did nothing wrong, but he realised that being criticised by someone in the role of president meant that he couldn't stay in the role. He had such respect for the role of president that he stepped down, and he actually died some years later, only about 4 or 5 years later. So he was president from 74 to 76, and he's the only president to have ever resigned out of office. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Patrick Hillary next, and then we had the two Marys then, of course.
Well, Patrick was a Fianna Fáil Minister for Foreign Affairs, and he was a Clare man. He was much behind the European Union, all that going on with the EEC at the time, and he became president. He was there for two terms, and then you had the two Marys after that, Mary Robinson and Mary McAleese, and that's closer to people's memories. And then you finally had Michael D. Higgins then, who we've had for the last two terms. But it's very interesting, again, we talked about how Carlo Daly resigned. Mary Robinson only did one term, and in fact she could have gone for president again this time. A president can stand again if they haven't stood a second time. So technically, she could have nominated herself to stand this time. But she wanted to leave the Irish presidential role sooner than the 7 years terms, because she was going to be appointed the UN Commissioner for Rights in the UN. And the government had words with her that they didn't want her to leave that early. I think she was talking about leaving in February, and the role would have to continue to October. So in a way, she kind of left the role early. And I personally, I thought that was disappointing, because the highest office in the land should be the role of president, and you shouldn't be looking to the left or right for another role. While you're president, you should fulfill that.
It's not a stepping stone, or you shouldn't be on LinkedIn. And why 7 years? Why not 5 years in line with you know, the likes of the councils or the Dáil? You know, 7 years, it sort of straddles administrations. Is there a thinking to that?
Well, I think there is, apart from maybe the biblical idea of seven. Seven's a perfect number, 7 days of the week, seven continents, seven seas. Seven is a perfect number. But I think the idea behind the seven, and I'm not 100% sure this, but it was to give stability, that if a government moves in and out in 5 years, that the president is still there, that this is something stable over a time, rather than it becoming a political football, changing somebody in and somebody out. And I like the idea of 7 years, because it does give stability. Look at America, where the presidential election is 4 years, and it creates...
But it's like
such...
two, really, isn't it? Because you've got two years, then you've got the midterms, and then I get where you're coming from. Listen, thanks so much for the overview, as always, Joe. We covered a lot there. I do appreciate your time. Have a great day, will you? And we'll chat again soon.
Same to yourself and your listener.
That is Dr. Joe Kelly there. Still time to get in your gardening questions, by the way, to 086 60 25,000. Paul McLaughlin's in for his last visit of this season. 07491 25,000 alternative if you want to give us a call. We're in studio with Paul McLaughlin, who is taking the last of the season questions about gardening. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you in.
Thank you.
Now, you might be your last scheduled visit with us for a while, but Paul's a guest speaker at the Swilly Gardening Club in the Youth Club Buncrana on Monday the 20th of October, and Margaret's looking forward to hearing about all the jobs that need to be done in the garden at this time of year. So this is not your last gig.
No. Actually, funny, I was just checking the book. There are a few more after that one, even.
Yeah, of course. All right. So, we have to free you up,
see. Yes, exactly. Christmas time's also busy.
Of course it is. So we're in autumn now, aren't we? Yes. The nighttime temperature is 2 to 7 degrees overnight and that type of stuff. Things are going to start slowing down.
Yes, absolutely. There's still a wee bit of, there's still good sort of temperature in the ground.
Right, okay. There's a lag there, isn't there?
But no, definitely sort of for bedding plants, that sort of stuff, it's really getting to the time where everything's slowing down now. Yeah. It's really getting down to the point where the growth's stopping, and there's probably the danger of frost coming in.
But what we do see is settled weather at the moment. High pressure is influencing our weather, not necessarily very high temperatures. Next week's going to be the same. So there's a window of good weather opportunity. What should we be doing?
Pretty much now's a good time to tidy up and actually sort of enjoy any time you get in the garden, sort of a bonus at the minute. But if you want to plant stuff like, say, structural stuff around the garden, trees, hedges, that sort of stuff, now's the perfect time.
Yeah, and you mentioned the heat in the soil with the moisture about. That sounds like ideal conditions for planting. What could we be at?
Absolutely. Like, say, your hedges, or even if you want to establish some shrubs in the garden, plant away now. And your spring bulbs too, obviously. It's a perfect time to put them in, because they'll get a wee bit of sort of growth on before the cold period comes.
Okay, and there might be some questions specific to that, but I'm just thinking that, you know, gardening, you're always sort of looking ahead, aren't you? So it's not all like just tidy up the garden, batten down the hatches for the winter. What could or should we be doing looking forward to spring and summer next year?
Yeah, pretty much now sort of is a good time to be planning what you're going to do next year. Once you consider your spring bulbs there, that's always planning for next year. And even just sort of maintaining the tidiness as much as anything else keeps the, like, raking up leaves, stuff like that, always keeps everything sort of fresher for next year.
When do we start seeing, if we haven't already, trees starting to and hedges starting to sort of change colour, thinking about shedding their leaves?
Yeah, pretty much you'd sort of see certain trees change different times. Like the horse chestnuts there, the conker trees, you can actually see it really, they've already started to change. And there are a few plants that are very striking about the county at the moment. They're the Virginian creepers or the Boston Ivy.
And what colour are they at the moment?
They're bright red. Right, really, okay. Like, if you're driving along, you would actually notice it and sort of stab you in your tracks, if you know what I mean. It's real sort of vibrant red. They'll do that for about a month now before they drop the leaves.
So when we talk about spring bulbs, what we can be planting, what are we talking about there?
Shedding your daffodils, tulips, crocuses, snowdrops, that sort of stuff, you know.
And there are variations within that, obviously. We were talking about the genetically modified daffodils last week, you were in, weren't we?
Yeah.
What's big bout bulbs? What's that? Bit about... Oh, sorry. That's a bit about bulbs.
Oh, very good.
All right, yeah. Because there's been a lot of interest about
yes,
bulbs.
Yes, huge funny since the last time I was on chatting about the bulbs, especially the pink daffodils being kind of a new variety out at the minute. Last year, or after being on here last week telling people about it, there were a good few calls about them and that, you know, because people are just always looking for them and that wee bit different.
Yeah, of course. And they are actually really stand out. Your neighbours will be going on, where did you get them? So... Like, I've been talking the last couple of times about sort of that transition from summer plants to winter plants. You know, people, you know, want to retain that bit of colour and life in their plant pots.
Yeah.
Are we at the point now where that's a really good time to do it?
Pretty much now is a good
time. Dependent on the summer flowers.
Yeah. Now it'd be a good time to be changing. All right. Funny, the more you drive about, the more you see people taking in the baskets, that sort of stuff. Now's a good time. People generally don't put out as much for the winter time, but most garden centres now have it. They have their sort of autumn stock in.
And just be conscious we're going to see more moisture, less drying weather, allow the good drainage and all that type of
stuff. Yes, exactly. Even if you have big pots, maybe put them up in pot feet at the minute. Would help just stop waterlogging over time.
There's wee trolleys you can get for them, actually. They're handy to move them around, but also serve the purpose of getting them a couple of feet off the ground. Perennials.
Perennials, yes. Now would be, we're getting into the time now if you have a lot of perennials where you could be starting to split some of them. Splitting them means just digging them up and dividing them. You're multiplying your stock of your perennials and you're just getting healthier plants. They're stopping them becoming root bound. So there's certain ones you do now and certain ones you would do in the springtime.
Now, you also mentioned hedges a little earlier on. This is the time, because we often get questions as to when is the right time. The conditions are perfect now. Yeah. Soil warm, plenty of moisture, but not then too much growth. Sort of heading in through the winter months, now is the ideal time.
Now is the ideal time for hedge planting, all right, because if you plant them in the summertime, you sort of have to keep them watered. So you stand out every evening watering them. Now the water will take care of itself and they're still enough to get them sort of established and rooted onto the ground before the worst of the winter comes.
Would that be reflected in footfall in garden centres at this time of year in terms of hedging?
Yes, funny, garden centres, you've different seasons sort of for different things. Sort of shrubs are kind of constant. Obviously, your bedding plants in the summer, but September really is just hedges. Would be a massive part of the thing.
Right, everyone's got a view on the new primary school curriculum, including yourself.
Exactly, I heard you had plenty of chat about it during the week.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, but gardening, once again, we would do a lot of work in schools, and gardening is a big part of the curriculum now, and it's good to see the new curriculum. There is a certain amount of gardening being
and outdoors as well, and understanding the benefits of it.
Yeah, I suppose it gives the kids gives them ownership of their area, gives them something to be proud of, like in terms of, I brought this from a seed out into an actual plant. And it sort of instills in them a love of nature and growing stuff, which is important sort of for life as you go on.
I mean, there's always life lessons. You know, people always go, you know, why do we learn algebra? Because I'm never going to use algebra as an adult. But it's what you learn while you're learning algebra and the tools that you learn to remember and stuff. It's not necessarily the gardening itself. It's understanding how things work.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And obviously then some kids are going to love it and become gardeners. But you know where I'm coming from.
I suppose generally kids as well. Anything outside the classroom as a novelty.
Yeah.
So they're always dying to get out.
Of course, and, you know, you're talking too about production of food and the fact that you can actually grow a lot of what you're eating
exactly.
at home.
And sort of from a health and nutrition point of view, it actually engages them better with it. And they're probably more inclined to eat vegetables if they've actually grown it themselves.
All right, stick your headphones on there, if you don't mind, please. Is there any headphones there?
No.
All right, Mary, hold where you are, because I'm going to take a very short break, because I have to take this break anyway. We'll be back with your question and loads more for Paul after these. Mary, are you there?
I am.
Mary, Paul, good to have you on the show, Mary. Paul McLaughlin's listening in as well. You've a wee question for him, Mary.
I have. Hello, Paul. Paul, my granddaughter brought home a sunflower seed from play school in probably May or June.
Yes.
A tiny pot. And I repotted it. And now I have it in her windowsill and it's almost nearly too big to come out of the windowsill. And I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, pretty much. Has it flowered yet or?
It hasn't, but you would think now that it is going to flower.
Yeah, there's still
a wee bud on the top.
Yeah, there's still potential for it to flower, all right. To be honest, at this stage of the year, I wouldn't be worried about moving it. If it's at all practical to leave it where it is, I would leave it where it is, you know.
Right.
Just keep it watered, and hopefully if it flowers then, and you get to enjoy the flower, and then you can harvest the seed off it again and plant them in the spring so you can keep the process going on, you know.
All right.
But, yeah.
So I wouldn't replanted outside or anything?
No, to be honest, because the temperatures are going down now, the sunflowers, generally they're a one season thing. So I would say the best potential you have for the flower would be to keep it inside at this
stage. You've got a wee bit now of an emotional attachment to this plant, Mary, do you?
Well, that's because she's asking every day, Granny, did you water my sunflowers?
Okay. So the pressure's on.
But you know, it's a lovely conversation to have. It's a lovely conversation with her to have that, you know, when it flowers, you can get a couple of seeds and grow a few more, and it'll always be from that one seed that she got you. So it can still turn into
an... she does love it.
Yes. Now, I would say there's still potential, hopefully potential for it to flower and everything, but I would, like I say, I'd be wary about putting it outside now. If you think it really needs repotted, you can pot it into a bigger pot and once again just leave it where it is, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Mary, I can see you. I can see you living in a shed outside and this sunflower taking over the house and you're afraid to...
I think so.
Lovely chat to you. Mary, thank you so very much. Hopefully that's good advice for you. Take care of yourself. Alex is with us too. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Greg. Hi there.
Paul's listening in. Alex, what's your question for Paul?
Hi, Paul. We're just having our street done. We're having it all dug up with the drains and everything. And we've got an old pond here, which all the line has gone out of it. And I was just, they very kindly have dug it out for us and they're going to run a drain down to it. And we're just wondering whether it is worth putting in a liner or not. I was just measuring it up there. So it's about 4.5 metres one way and about 5.5-6 metres the other way. And I'm just wondering, do I need a liner? Maybe with all the rain and if rainwater is draining into it, maybe I don't need one.
Yeah, it's quite a substantial size. All right, so it is. Now, to be honest, I would say you'd probably be better with a liner. It depends on your individual site, if you know what I mean. If you have sort of a clay-based soil, it would hold the water quite well. But if your garden's fairly free draining, it may, like if you're in a slope, it may sort of empty out as the summer goes on, especially if the feeds aren't coming into it.
Unfortunately, look, no, it's not actually, Paul. You might remember it. You came and very kindly put down a polytunnel for us. It was just literally next door to us. We're down in Remelton.
Yes, I remember.
We've spoken to you before, but the groundsman, the contractor has discovered when he dug down the trench that just only about half a foot was the decent soil, and all the rest of it looks like clay. So, in fact, this lawn tends to pool in the winter, tends to puddle in the winter. So that's what I'm just wondering whether it is hanging on to water quite a lot.
Yes, I suppose
other than water retention, is there any function for the liner?
No, it's pretty much just water retention.
Yeah, so if you're satisfied, Alex, if you're satisfied it'll hold the water even when it's not raining, you could find yourself, though, you know, 6 weeks into a dry summer and you could be looking at an empty pond too. Is that the risk?
See, the problem there would be a lot of people would use ponds like that sort of to attract wildlife.
Mm.
And the big thing would be if you had frog spawn or something in it, that and it dried out then, obviously it would be a loss. If you know what I mean. Probably the sensible thing probably would be to look at it for a season.
Try a summer.
Just and see how you get on and just monitor the level as you go. And like, once again, if it's dug out now, even to come back, revisit it next year, if you think it needs a liner, most of the work's done anyway. So,
yes. So
I would nearly chance it for the first season
and
see how you get on.
Yeah, no, that sounds like sound advice. Makes sense, actually.
Alex, is there anyone in your life that disagrees with you and believes a liner should go into it come what may, or is this your own unilateral decision? Because I'll tell you why, right? Because this sounds to me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, it sounds to me that someone in that house has a different opinion to you, right? But Paul has said what you think. That's what I'm getting. That's the vibes I'm getting, Alex. Am I right or wrong?
Is my wife on the phone to you on another day?
No, but I'll tell you the joy when you said give it a season and you're thinking, all right, I'm going to get myself a ride-on lawnmower or a little punt for the lake. That's how it sounded to me, Alex. You sounded like a man that feels he's just won an argument.
Well, do you know what, Greg? I think actually my wife will be coming back to me and saying, I told you so.
All right, okay. All right, brilliant stuff. Well, Alex, send a love to her. Okay, thanks so very much indeed. Lovely to chat to you. All right. Right, Paul, is it okay to cut back roses and shrubs now and plant cuttings in pots of the same?
Yes, pretty much. Cuttings, as we be getting a wee bit late for cuttings, but cutting them back at this stage, yes. Cut away at them now, and you can do your final cuts in spring In terms of growing them on from cuttings, hardwood cuttings probably would work all right. So it's just a matter of, whenever you're cutting them anyway, you may take a chance.
We know it's a good time to plant a hedge. That's the first part of the question. But what type of hedge would be best near the sea?
Near the sea, our go-to is always the Griselinia, which even the Latin name of it says, the Latin name of it is Griselinia littoralis, which means beside the sea, which generally has a waxy leaf that salt spray doesn't interfere with. If you're in a very exposed place, like we would send a lot of stuff out to the islands, Arranmore and Torrey, Olearia traversii would be the one for out there.
Okay.
But Griselinia generally.
I planted a cherry laurel hedge in May from potted plants. I've fed them with chicken pellet, liquid seaweed and watered late evening during warm periods, but yet they seem to be struggling with the leaves turning yellow. I'm afraid of losing the hedge during the winter.
Once again, now at this time of year, I would, depends when they're planted, obviously.
But, May. They planted it in May. May.
Yeah, I would treat it with a chicken pellet again. Now, generally, they work over the course of 3 months. The likes of the liquid feeds of that would be sort of short-lived. So I would give it a good feed now, try and build it up for the winter.
There's no danger that they're over-feeding?
To be honest, the yellow leaves would suggest to me that it's still under-feeding.
Okay.
A laurel is a particularly hungry plant. So it is. And just keep an eye on the water levels. Sometimes it can turn yellow if they're sitting in too much water.
I'm not sure if this is a recent question or a carryover. Millipedes climbing and entering the house.
Yes, millipedes. This time of year it can be a problem, or it's sort of as the weather changes, gets colder, they're looking for better shelter, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Generally coming into the house, the best thing to do is, even if you cover your, like the underside of your windowsills or even the bottom of the plastic window with a bit of Vaseline or something like that, will actually just creates a barrier that they don't want to cross. And millipedes as well, you can hoover them up kind of, but don't be tempted if they're known to sort of squash them, because they actually, whatever's in the body can actually stain, like say you had a white windowsill. Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Nuts. Yeah, can do that, you know.
There's a dye within them. Okay.
Yeah, what's so now best? Just create a barrier, I suppose.
Yeah, it's quite organic, but that's what you have to do in it. What's the best time to cut down a willow rose?
Roses now, sort of, if it's finished flowering, basically cut her back now, cut her back to almost where you want it, and recut her in the spring if it's St. Patrick's Day, just to get the sort of broken edges off it.
Sow grass now or wait to Feb?
No, perfect time. The weeds won't germinate with it, and you still have plenty of moisture. And also,
it's great when we get questions that hit just right at the moment.
Yes,
and that one,
exactly.
That one sounds great. Can you grow hawthorns from slips?
Yes, you can. May, June are the perfect time to do that. You can only do it really from softwood cuttings, which is the new growth in the plant. It's still quite flexible. Traditional way, like even 100 years ago, was collect the seeds at this time of year and put them into like a barrel of water for a few months and then plant the seeds, and would be nearly as quick as the cuttings.
I love wild bluebells. Would they be difficult to grow? And if not, what time of the year? Thanks.
It's one you have to be careful with. Most of the stuff you buy in the garden centre at the minute would be Spanish bluebells, which are not the obviously native wild ones. They can be relatively cheap. You can source the wild ones. Wild Irish ones would be five times as expensive. So it'd be quite expensive. But in terms of having a patch of them, it is illegal under the Flora Act in 2015 to actually disturb an existing patch of bluebells.
Mm.
So obviously, if you want the native ones, you can source them. Most garden centres can get them for you, but just
they're gonna
expensive.
Pay. All right. Yeah. How do you cut back hydrangeas so you're doing it correctly?
Yes, hydrangeas. Basically, hydrangeas are very forgiving. You can cut away at it and it'll be happy enough. So cut it back, even if you want to be particularly severe with it, cut it back to within a foot of the ground.
Mm-hmm. I call her as a yellow rose bush. It's growing out of control. What to do?
Yes, give it a good cutting back.
No problem.
Once it's finished flowering, basically, cut her back and basically, yeah, from now on, be perfect.
A caller has crows landing on their grass, poking holes with their beaks. What can you do to resolve the problem?
Yes, funny, it seems to be a huge problem this year. So it does actually. Well, the weather was quite dry and lawns were very dry. And basically, them 2 weeks rain we had, seems to have activated whatever's in the soil. The crow's not after the lawn, the crow's after some manner of insect that's in the lawn.
Mm.
So basically try and diagnose that first and solve that problem. But crows are also notoriously curious, and if anything's happened to your lawn, like even sometimes if you fertilise it, it can actually just changes the lawn.
Mm.
And the crows will come and investigate, and then if they find something. So it can be a temporary thing. If you want to keep them away and break the habit, if you get some sewing thread and just run it over and back the garden, even a few sticks, they're wary of getting near it. So
yeah,
that would probably keep them away. But it's generally, and something they get as an insect is in the lawn that they're after.
I have a laurel hedge. Most of it's grown well, but a few plants are not growing and leaves have turned yellow. It's been like this for ages. Plants not dead, just not growing.
Yes, probably similar to your last question.
Need some dindins.
Nutrition would be the main problem. All right.
I have flowers in the garden that I want to move and replant elsewhere. Could I do that now, or when is the best time to do it? I'm afraid the frost might kill them, as many of them are mature plants.
Yes, I suppose it very much depends on what sort of plant it is. As we discussed earlier, if it's perennials, now would be a good enough time to move them and sort of divide them if you need to. Shrub-wise, if they're sort of deciduous, I would leave them another few months. Frost won't really do them any harm. So just don't do it whenever the ground's frozen. But a lot of the sort of shrubby stuff likes in the dormant season, so it likes in the winter time to remove it. But maybe ask in your local garden centre, take a few photos and they should be able to advise.
I have a vine in my polytunnel and it has a lot of black grapes. How do I cut it back as it's taken over the whole tunnel and when?
Yes, funny, grapevines can be very vigorous, so they can, they can just absolutely take over a tunnel altogether.
I actually did hear that through the grapevine, believe it or not.
Oh, very good. But no, generally, if they have a lot of black grapes, obviously whenever they're mature, harvest away at them. And they're grand, what I call it. Enjoy them. But in terms of cutting back, you have to wait till it goes absolutely dormant. So the ideal time would be January, February.
Okay.
And probably, once again, YouTube would be your friend in terms of what. But at that time of year, you can actually see the whole structure of the plant.
So you can actually see
where you're going.
Yeah. Okay, just time for one more. Some very nice geraniums that I'd like to keep over the winter, but I'm not sure they would survive frost. Is there anything I can do, such as dig them out and put them away for the winter?
Yes, geraniums, perfect plants. I suppose they were always the traditional sort of garden plant everybody's granny had in the garden. The main benefit of them was, at this time of year, you can actually dig them up, pot them, bring them in the house, overwinter them in a windowsill, and back out again in the spring, or sort of into May, if you know what I mean. But no, just dig up, make sure you take plenty of soil with you, and put them in a decent sized pot. And they'll be happy enough in the house over the winter.
Brilliant stuff as always, Paul. Listen, we might end up chatting over the course of the winter with different bits and bobs that may well come up. But thank you so much for joining us throughout the season. Really appreciate it. Thank you for the nice wee gifts here and there.
Well,
I've got myself a nice little McLaughlin polytunnel hat. I love the way you're trying to frame it as if it's nice for me, whereas I'm just going to be your walking advertising hoarding really now, isn't
it? Yes, well, that's the hat. It's beneficial to both of us, shall we say.
Listen, thank you so much for everything, as
thank you for having me over the spring
and summer, and we'll chat very soon. It doesn't belong going around, does it?
Absolutely.
We're going to be
talking
about daffodils in no time at all. All right, Paul McLaughlin of Ballagdar Garden Centre. Call in and see Paul and the crew there. If you have any questions or any of our amazing garden centres that we have right across the region, they're all great, all have really friendly staff, and we'll look after you. And we'll be back with more shortly. Right, now Anne emailed us and said, and I can't read it all, since my email to you all on the 14th of September, and this is, it'll become clear as I read it out, I've heard from some TDs, Paul McLaughlin, Pierce Doherty, Charles Ward and Councillor Micheál Colum-McGillan-Aspic, who've written to the ISPCA and or Minister Hayden requesting an investigation into response to action against an appalling decision and situation. The ISPCA has predictably just regurgitated its weak rationale and stance, not even bothering to update or amend its media statement, which I think says a lot. There's been a deafening silence, however, from the minister and his department. Today, TD Ward raised the matter in the Dáil and spoke eloquently and robustly. I couldn't believe the poor response he got, and that this issue was apparently not previously known about by the minister and the department, despite the numerous queries and concerns raised, and would be looked into. Very poor show. Listen. We'll see. They're going to look into it. We'll see what the story is. So, Kathleen Murray, one of the original founding members of the ISPCA, Donegal Animal Rehabilitation Centre. You would have heard from the ISPCA either when he was on the show or after the fact, Kathleen, that they've looked at the numbers. It just doesn't make sense. And if the truth be told, they're probably planning to develop a more centralised centre down the country, and it's still not clear what's going to happen to the great facilities that are there. I mean, is that how you see their position at this point?
Well, there's a time factor on it, and that is pretty urgent now, because now on the 1st of October, which is Monday, I think, ISPCA and the DSPCA will have merged, and they will now be officially operating as the NSPCA, the National SPCA. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a different company, a different thing altogether, a different setup, and the centre will belong to both of them because they've merged, and that makes things a lot more difficult than they were. And I say the urgency is unbelievable, and that's why I want to hold a second protest, because I want people to understand the importance of that centre to the county, because so many people have availed of the services there, and so many people have adopted animals from there and have contributed, have donated. People have died and left their money to the animals of Donegal, which are, were all put into that centre with a long-term plan in mind for the ISPCA to run it and to basically respect those legacies.
They said they will. They said that if they sell it on, they will sell it on so for its current use, so to speak. That's what he said to me anyway. Is that satisfactory at all?
Well, selling it on is going to mean that they're moving out of the county, apart from the inspector. And everything that all neglect cases, all cruelty cases, all serious cases are all going to be have to ferried or be ferried down the country to one of their centres down there. And that's madness when we already have a centre in the county. It's absolute madness. And some of the local TDs, etc., have raised questions on the Dáil, but the answers they're getting are, I can only describe them as pathetic, because people have absolutely no grasp of what's going on here, nor, to be perfectly honest, do I think, I actually think they really don't care, because Donegal is way up there.
But they looked at the figures. Like, they've said the very survival of the services that they're providing is based on them downsizing, that they have to rationalise their expenses, how much is going out versus how much is going in. They say, if we don't make these decisions now, the whole ship could go down.
Well, I would hazard a guess that if they had let us know in time in Donegal when they thought they were running into financial difficulties, that we could have kept that centre going with donations, with awareness, with whatever. But they didn't let us know.
But they did,
and that's
say they
so
did a
mad,
specific...
Maddening.
They did. I did get sent it. They did do a specific... And I wasn't aware of it. A specific fundraiser, really, to try and protect the services in Donegal. It was... Caroline might have the data or the information on it, but I wasn't aware of it, but it certainly was put out there at some point.
I wasn't even aware of it, and that tells you something.
No, it tells me everything, really, if the truth be told.
If for 1 minute I thought that centre was going downhill, we could have rallied behind it, we could have helped out a lot, but they didn't let the animal welfare charities know, nor did they run any big campaign.
Okay.
And the centre's in Donegal, so there's no need to run it down the country. If you ran it in Donegal, the Donegal people would help to keep the centre for themselves, because it's all their animals that would have been going into it. And so, you know, people are very generous in the county, and they would have helped us out in so many ways.
Well, the protest will be held on Sunday at 3:30 PM outside the centre. And what is the motivation of... No, we know what the motivation is, right? But what are you protesting? That the ISPCA reverse the decision? That the government become involved? What is the focus of the protest, if there is one?
Yeah, all of the above is to raise awareness, because there's a lot of people who still don't know that the centre is closed. And it's to raise more awareness in the government and with the ISPCA, that we do not want to give up the centre. We do not want the centre moving out of the county. And if it is, we'll at least give us back some of the money from the legacy so we can actually use it for its original purpose, which they know about, because they had that money earmarked for Donegal before the centre was even built.
So when you talk about the legacy,
the
would if they handed over the building, would that be what you're talking of?
Well, if they handed over the building, then the Donegal people can decide if they want to sell the building and use the money directly for animals or whether they want to keep the building going. That would be the choice of the people of the county then, and the animal charities could get behind it and honour at least what they want. What
I just have a strong feeling that that building is on the assets book, and that's not going to happen. But, I mean, that's how the legacies are fulfilled, isn't it? That the asset becomes the ownership of the people once again. But as I say, I don't think that's going to happen. But
because it should, whatever was going to happen, it should have stayed in Donegal, or at least the animal charities in Donegal could have been contacted and see what suggestions they can come up with, or what help or what backup, because they can be very resourceful, and they know the scene for many years. They've been well overworked. And I would, you know, desperately get behind them because they need the money.
Okay.
Because they deal with the animals on the ground. Now, I would like to thank, say, Mary T. Sweeney and Charles Ward and all the people that have spoken up and brought up the questions in the Dáil. But the answers they got were pathetic, less than pathetic, because they don't seem to know anything about the county, nor have they any interest at all. It's an absolute disgrace.
All right. The protest takes place.
Because
this,
one answer was that, they hope that basically the problem will be resolved and that we'll be able to get a centre somewhere, you know, close to the northwest or in the surrounding counties. We don't need that. We just need to keep the one we have. It's perfectly workable, you know, if people get behind it. But the one we have is the one we want. We don't want to have to travel to Sligo and Leitrim and Longford.
But what
and
about animals
else,
in Leitrim and Longford? And what about animals that are in Leitrim, Roscommon, North Mayo? Do they not deserve convenient access in a more central location?
They absolutely do, and that's up to the ISPCA. And the ISPCA, they're the ones that started all this. Okay. So they're the ones that should actually provide a centre for them, because our centre was provided by people who left their legacies in their wills for the animals of Donegal, and that's all we want to honour, is just give them the money that they deserve.
Okay, Kathleen, there's also a change.org petition, Save Our Donegal Animal Rehabilitation Centre. You can search that out or check Kathleen's socials. Thank you. And that protest, if you're interested, is at the Donegal Animal Rehabilitation Centre, which is now closed. It's at 3:30 p.m. this coming Sunday. Right, John Bresson is going to be broadcasting around the Northwest live from the Finn Valley Centre. It's part of the DCITS Sports Day. That's the Donegal Community Inclusion Training Services. It's a HSE-led day service that serves adults between the age of 18 to 65 with intellectual disabilities. And it's live coming up after 12 until 2:30 p.m. And there's a sports day running between 11 now and 2 p.m. So get along to that and say hello to the crew and support the team there. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 with the Friday panel, etc. Join us then. Have a great Thursday.